as I get closer to where he went off the road, I see a big black shape in the middle of the road walking. So I have to slam on my brakes and try to swerve myself because this thing is walking in the center of the road. Because I don't see a head and I don't see arms. I just see a really big, tall person, like big, thick legs and a big, thick torso. And they're moving very funny.
But to be honest, I wish I had have seen some of her vulnerability. I wish I'd have seen her in that space so that I would have language.
And he says, no. That's not why you're angry. That's why you're mad. Mad is on the surface. Mad is a surface emotion. You're angry. And anger is deep. That cuts to your soul. You are an angry young man. And I couldn't answer. I then had come to realize over the next course of a few hours, I'm musing to myself, and I realize I've been a victim my whole life. That's why I'm so angry. And over the course of the next 19 months, this man changed my life. He helped me to realize about processing emotion and how to forgive myself and forgive others. And that's where the metamorphosis really began for me. And I learned how to, I'm a survivor, right? I know how to survive.
I was understood for the first time in my entire life. And when I read those things and I learned, quote unquote, those things about myself that I had known forever, but never really had the semantics for, I couldn't unlearn them. Like I heard this quote years ago and it resonated with me so much. And it's like, you can choose to look the other way, but you can never again say you didn't know.
Hello, friends. Welcome back. Today I have author Nicholas Pearson. He's been immersed in all aspects of the mineral kingdom for 30 years. As one of the leading voices in crystal magic and healing today, Nicholas offers a unique blend of science and spirituality alongside a grounded, practical approach to working with stones. He's an internationally renowned speaker and the award-winning author of 9 books, including Crystal Basics, Stones of the Goddess, Crystals for Psychic Self-Defense. You can find him online at theluminouspearl.com and on Instagram. He has an amazing spiritual and healing community, and I want to welcome Nicholas to the show.
Hello, welcome everyone. Today I have Nicholas Pearson on. So excited to have Nicholas here. Welcome to the Verbal Echo.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I've been looking forward to our conversation.
Yes, I have been following you for quite a while, and I recently had Benjamin Stenson on, and I just released his episode today. Really fascinating. And come to find out, you two know each other. And so I was really honored to be able to connect with you and bring this information to my listeners. We're going to talk all about crystals, and you have a new book coming out. And so I guess my first question is, how did you fall into this space?
Well, thank you so much for having me. I've been a lifelong mineral nerd. I was the very stereotypical small child whose pockets were always lined with rocks. It didn't really matter where we went. If I found something intriguing to me, something that like spoke to me on this really visceral level, it came home with me. So, real exotic locations like family vacations to the mountains, or our, weekly treks to the beach during summertime, or, the especially rare and precious stones you find in gravel driveways and grocery store parking lots. Those were like my favorites. And I was pretty discerning. It wasn't every rock. Something had to be special about it. And my grandfather, I guess, having witnessed this behavior for years and years and years, finally gave me my very first like proper mineral specimen. It was a piece of quartz I later discovered comes from Hot Springs, Arkansas. around the same time, I just fell in love with my grandmother's like vintage turquoise jewelry collection, and just the world of gemstones drew me in. And it was like touching something straight out of a fairy tale. I've always been a lover of folklore and fairy tales and mythology, and here was something that felt really tangible as an extension of myth and legend. It was a real life object imbued with magic to me. And then I just kind of pursued that the best you can until you have agency of your own and can like spend your own money and buy your own things. But by the time I, could spend my hard-earned cash in the bookstore, I discovered there was this practice of crystal healing that people still engaged with. It wasn't just something from folklore. It wasn't something that you read about in ethnographies. It wasn't just, a piece of mythology. It was a real living, breathing practice. And it became a place where I could take my folkloric interests as well as my scientific interests and kind of put them together. And I'm really lucky that when I went away to college to study music, I was allegedly randomly assigned to work at the Earth Science Museum on campus. I didn't even know it existed. I chose this university for its really prestigious music school. And it turns out that my work assignment is to like be up close and personal with a historic collection of over 5,000, I'm sorry, 50,000 specimens, one of the largest collections in the southeastern United States. So it was just a great time to immerse myself in the scientific side of mineralogy and geology and other earth and environmental sciences, and start to find these emerging trends in the energies that I was experiencing in the folklores that I read. And I've really never looked back. It's been this, really deep part of my practice ever since.
That's interesting that you found your way through music. And I think that we fall into these things through other avenues, and maybe that's just our path. And that's really cool. I know I found my way through a lot of spirituality with things that you would never, like, how did I get here? And it's just so weird. I have had the honor of coming to some of your online Reiki shares. And those were so fun. And I know that you have a lot of offerings that you participate in just in your whole healing practice. And being a light worker, I think, is just kind of a large umbrella to put you in, if I could even. And so I was wondering if you could tell us about some of the other things that you do in the healing space.
Absolutely. So in spring of 2004, I began my teaching practice at probably an age that was too young to teach people anything about life, but I could sure teach people about rocks and energy. And that led me over the next couple of years to kind of broaden my internal focus. Like what I wanted to learn and study and practice began to expand beyond just the world of crystals. And Reiki was this really like catalytic moment for me. I suppose I've always had a love of Japan, its language, its culture, its history. I don't really know where that comes from. I just like it. And then to find this healing practice that stems from early 20th century Japan, and to like meet a teacher I really clicked with, herself half Japanese, spent the first part of her life over there. It really imparted me a profound love and appreciation for the practice of Reiki, of Usui Reiki Ryoho, as it's traditionally called. And I've made a very long and ongoing study. Even though I teach the system, I am still perennially a student. I'm still learning that from other perspectives and other lineages, tracing common threads. And so a big part of what I do when I work with the public are my monthly online Reiki shares that I do, for your sliding scale. I teach Reiki classes across the US, and occasionally speak at conferences. I'm also a big proponent of flower essence therapy. When I went away to school, it's a really uncertain time in a lot of people's lives to like go have to be something that passes for a functional adult. I don't think we have enough grooves in our brain to really be called grown-ups yet, but we have to at least cosplay as them. And those big stresses in life and those big changes and like trying to figure out your identity and what you want to do with the rest of your life is a lot to ask of a teenager. And I think like a lot of teenagers, some kind of latent patterns in my life came to a head. And what had been, I don't know if manageable is the right word, what had been sweepable under the rug as far as an anxiety disorder. Suddenly you couldn't sweep it under the rug. The pile got too big and we were tripping over it every day. So flower essences were one of the tools that I used to help manage that. You know, my regular meditation practice, my hands-on Reiki practice, they were certainly very useful. Going down the allopathic care route, you know, looking at pharmaceuticals, talking to mental health care experts, they were all also really important. But I found with flower essences, you know, this mysterious little bottle of mostly water could help take the edge off of an anxiety attack. It could take, you know, the panic away from fever pitch. It didn't make it disappear altogether, but it helped me manage the symptoms so I could have space to look at the root cause. And it was just incredible. And my dear friend Rita Truax, who has since retired but owned the very first crystal shop in my hometown where I ever taught a class, she you know, made sure I had a constant supply of flower essence blends to take with me to college for quite some time. And you know, I've kind of come back to that practice after many years exploring flower essence therapy from a few different facets, studying with some really incredible teachers, learning about different modalities, different makers of essences. So, you know, that's been a really wonderful tool to have in my toolbox. And, you know, I try to keep myself new and fresh by studying things that are outside of my wheelhouse too. So there's probably more in that toolkit we could yammer on about, but it would take all day.
I hear you. I like that you said, I'm always a student. I consider myself always a student. If I learn something new every day, it just keeps me young. and I am wondering, now I have to get your book on flower essences. And it's called Flower Essences from the Witch's Garden, right?
Yeah.
And yeah. And is this similar to Bach flower remedies? Is that very similar, like the process that they use? Because I did read a book on Bach, and I was just wondering if that was similar.
Yeah. So Edward Bach, or Edward Bach, depending on who you ask, is the founder of like our modern idea of flower essence therapy. He was a brilliant clinician, and he was a bacteriologist and immunologist. He eventually went into the homeopathic route. He got like recruited into one of the leading homeopathic hospitals, had a really lucrative medical practice, and decided that he wanted to find an alternative or complementary route to healing that didn't focus so much on disease and focus more on wellness as our end goal, looking at the kind of psycho-spiritual things that exist in tandem with states of imbalance. And so over the last few years of his life, he created these 38 remedies from 37 different plants and then one that's just water. That is solarized. And, you know, over the ensuing decades, you know, this would be like the 1930s, in the coming decades, we'd eventually get some other makers to pop up in a few other parts of the world, following very similar principles, some intentionally modeling their work after Bach, some of them, you know, coming upon the same kind of practice through intuitive means, you know, being shown by the wisdom of the plants, the wisdom of spirit itself. And, you know, honestly, even this notion of modern flower essence therapy exists along a larger continuum of praxis that takes us to traditional herbalism in many parts of the world, traditional medicines, into like the plant spirit medicine side of things. We see that it shares roots with alchemical praxis in the medieval and early modern period. And like, there's this wonderful thread that we can find a sense of continuity with that brings us to many practices, flower essence therapy being among them. So the book that I wrote was my pandemic baby. When we had to like press pause on a whole lot of stuff in 2020, my most popular book came out, Crystal Basics. And I had a lot planned to like celebrate the release of that across the country. And obviously I didn't do any of that. And that was okay. The way it worked out afforded me a chance to do some reflection, learn some new skills. And after like really kind of just leaning into flower essence therapy, because I wanted to challenge myself and do something different, I had one of those like totally cliche, like shampooing my hair kind of moments where like the title of a book came to me, Flower Essences from the Witch's Garden. I was like, Yeah, I do some weird things with essences I've never seen in a book. Maybe I should put them in a book and like create this bridge between like magical herbalism and vibrational medicine and something that kind of exists with a foot in both of those realms. And that's where the notion was born. So, you're going to see the historical context of Dr. Bach and his brilliant work and the people who followed in his footsteps. You're going to find inspirations from other sources, traditional herbalism, magical herbalism, the poison path, so many things kind of get worked into it. And it's got exercises for making your own remedies, how to blend them effectively. And of course, store-bought is also great. So there's an appendix of different flower essence suppliers in the back. If you're not a do-it-yourselfer, I want to make sure that I met everybody's needs. And then it has a directory of 100 different essences in there. That are, you're going to find some standards from the line of batch remedies. You're going to find some from a lot of other famous makers. And then you'll also find some that are kind of obscure but delightful plants that I've gotten to know over the years. And I wanted to let their voices be heard as well.
Their voices. I love that. I think, yeah, all plant medicine, plant spirit medicine. I'm trying to remember. I listened to an Audible book on plant spirit medicine, and now I'm dropping a blank as far as the name, but he's quite famous, and there are a lot of authors out there that do research that and bring that information forward with the history of plants, and it kind of some of it kind of goes into shamanism and traditional ancestral wisdom. And so, if anyone's interested, definitely check out just dive down that rabbit hole. It's really fascinating, and it sounds like your book really it. Kind of gives a little bit more hands-on in addition to the history and that sounds really fascinating. Yeah, I'm really resonating with that. I love that.
Thank you.
Yeah. So I'm wondering if you could give us a little bit of a background on how the crystals work if someone is new to this and they, I mean, because I think there's a lot of things out there, especially on Instagram, and you just see all, all kinds of people talking about their stones and their crystals. And if you could just give us a little bit of 101 on how they work with the realm of healing.
Yeah, so the human mineral relationship goes back pretty much to the beginning of humans. We have evidence that is pre-Homo sapiens, by some estimates, maybe 500,000 years ago, where hominids went out of their way to collect quartz in particular, but also occasionally other things. And what exactly they did with them in a very specific kind of sense, I can't presume to know. We can't reconstruct belief systems and healing modalities and religious praxis after this much time has elapsed with so little material evidence. But it does go to show that there really is nothing new under the sun. And in this huge expanse of time from, far, far, far before recorded history to today, there have been a lot of theories and a lot of different models for how stones work. Some of them are very simplistic and focus on things like symbolism, metaphor, color therapy. Others are very spirit-driven. Some use like astrological models, which we still find in some practices, like in the Vedic kind of gem therapy that's in use today. It has been for a very long time, which is driven by like Vedic astrology or Jyotish. And then we also have ideas that are rooted in the observable phenomena of rocks and minerals. So there's this notion called the doctrine of signatures, which is really important in traditional herbalism, but it also applies to other realms of healing. And particularly in like the medieval lapidary tradition, the tradition where folks wrote these like dictionaries of healing stones, for lack of a better way to describe it, this doctrine of signatures was like very simplistic and very metaphorical. But over time, from like a generation or so before me into today, we see people applying similar principles to things like the chemical composition, the crystal structure, the formation process, to find the symbolism encoded and these things that are, related to the material body, the kind of immutable principles. Quartz is always the same chemical formula. It always has the same crystal structure. It generally occurs in the same kinds of environments, geologically speaking. So if we start to decode the meaning of those things, if we start to observe cause and effect and finding that like common thread, oh, all of these things that are rich in zinc, tend to have this kind of energy, or minerals that contain lots of iron have this kind of energy, or minerals that belong to the triclinic crystal system have a kind of energetic personality to them that's similar in this way. We can start to decode what crystals do. And that has led me to a model that I use for explaining how crystal energy works, wherein we look at some really basic interactions that crystals have with, energy on several levels, and use that as like a model for explaining how subtle energy, which we can't measure, that's why we call it subtle energy, how it must also interface with crystals and with us. And in this kind of model, because crystals have this really perfectly organized structure, all of the little parts and pieces fit together in the same kind of fundamental shape, which we call a unit cell, and that repeats over and over again to fill all the available space. So if we have this perfect, rhythmic, coherent structure, it's going to cause energies to respond to it in perfected and coherent ways. And our systems are anything but coherent. I mean, if you think about it, your eyeballs are made out of different stuff than your bones. And that's a good thing. We need them to be. The electromagnetic pulses of your heart and brain don't always sync up, and they are different to other cells in your body as well. So, we create this kind of cacophony of vibrations as a result of all of these different parts and processes working, often together, but sometimes antagonistically. Throw in our thoughts, emotions, and feelings and other stuff, and it gets a little murkier. So the magic here is that crystals have this precision to them. And so when we introduce a crystal to our energy field, it helps organize our energy field to be similarly precise, to vibrate inharmonically, we might say, to resonate harmoniously or in sympathy with the energy of that stone. And that creates these kinds of ripple effects that we call entrainment, where our energy field and that of the crystal begin to synchronize over time. We have plenty of rigorous and robust studies that show coherence in the human energy field, particularly heart and brain coherence, is a hallmark of health. Not every scientist out there will make a statement about causality, that those two things happening together create health, but certainly we see them coexisting. They correlate really strongly. And if we can affect changes at the electromagnetic level, we begin to see changes in things like mood, perception, mental affect. In other words, how we think and feel. How we think and feel changes a lot of other things that happen on a very physical, visceral kind of way when it comes to chemical transmitters and electrical impulses that cascade through the body and begin to shape our metabolism and catabolism and other forces in the body. So there is a possible pathway whereby energy begins to supersede our pathology. Can we prove this with a peer-reviewed study? Not yet. I would love to see it. Hasn't been done yet. There's some anecdotal studies that have been published, some of which by clinicians, just not in peer-reviewed journals yet. And I'm hopeful that maybe we'll start to see some like really viable ways for working with crystals in that clinical field at some point in the future.
And that's the problem with science. And I love science. And definitely anyone, please get your information from peer review. Don't always, like the internet is not always 100% true. It's interesting that you're talking about entrainment and thought sequencing and coherence. Like right now I'm taking a music class. It's a drumming, healing for drumming class. And that is training on music entrainment with it helps support people with ADHD and anxiety and depression. And there's a lot of evidence to show that as you're drumming, and you're using this sequence of music and sound, you can entrain the brain toward healing. And so when you were talking about entrainment, I was instantly thinking about this new thing that I'm learning about. And you, from a music background, I'm sure you know about this. And so there's just a lot of symmetry here between what you're doing with the crystals. And I love the science aspect of this, because that's the world we live in. I think we need a little bit of validity, and that's where we seek answers, right?
Yeah. You know, I've always found like we'll say the scientific method and not so scientific, but more spiritually driven praxis to foundationally take us to the same place. Like whether we are pursuing science by dissecting and quantifying and measuring and postulating, or whether we are philosophizing and spiritualizing and you know, otherwise exploring in a metaphysical sense, we're doing the same thing. And that is trying to make sense of the world around us and how we fit into it. And, you know, one works in measurement and the other works in metaphor. And if we don't have both, we don't have a lot of meaning in life. We need concrete things that we can measure and quantify, but we also need the parallel road of symbolism. We need dreams, we need stories, we need narratives, we need myth and poetry. And so for me, science and spirit have always, you know, kind of locked in together. I never experienced a whole lot of cognitive dissonance immersing myself in some like myth or legend about, you know, how we get rain or where the sun comes from, and then learning about the water cycle and, you know, what's happening with precipitation, or, you know, discovering how stars are birthed. Like one doesn't cancel out the other for me. In fact, each one enriches my understanding and appreciation for the other. And I think we're at a time where more people can do that. It doesn't have to be only this or only that. We're getting a lot more interplay where people have space to learn things that, you know, might occasionally burst a bubble. But if we focus on metaphor versus truth, if we think of things as being poetically true rather than factually true, then we can have our fact and our poetry at the same time.
So well said. So well said. And, oh, I'm really resonating with what you're saying. So well said, as far as, and I'm sure any of your books really dive into this. If you could think of something that you would like to dispel, I know there are probably a lot of non-truths out there regarding stones and crystals. And is there something that you would like to kind of say, hey, there's a lot of misinformation about this one thing, and if you could clear something up, what would it be?
Oh gosh, there, it's a long list. So
okay, pick one.
This is one of the things that I love doing. Not because I love bursting bubbles, but because I love like understanding how and why things work. So let's pick like a really easy tool that people use to relate to their crystals, and like break it down to show that it's maybe not the end all and the be all. And for me, that is the relationship between crystals and color and chakras. And we start to think of this kind of like immutable relationship. Blue crystals are for the throat chakra. We use them for communication. And yellow crystals are for the solar plexus and therefore maybe confidence. And we kind of leave it at that. But there are a few... there are a few glaring holes in this model. Firstly, I want to start by saying, if it works for you, I'm not telling you not to do it. That's the big one. But secondly, I also want to point out that it's a small piece of the puzzle when it comes to crystal energy. So if we look at something like amethyst is functionally speaking, almost pure quartz, and quartz in its ideal state, no imperfections, is colorless. If I took a 1-foot cube of clear quartz and wanted to turn it into amethyst, the amount of chemical difference between them is a very small amount of iron, a few stray ions of it here or there. In that 1 foot cube, you need not more iron than you're going to find in the tip of a ballpoint pen. So they're almost identical. Chemically, they're more or less identical. Structurally, there's some twinning involved, but we won't get into that. So why is it we perceive such a big difference energetically and socially and symbolically when one is violet and one is transparent? And I think it is just that. It is social, it is cultural, it is psychological. A certain amount of it is vibrational, but maybe not as much as we attribute to it. I had a really important mentor in the world of crystal healing who's since retired. And, you know, she literally became a, at one point in her life, one of her many hats she wore was like receptionist or something along those lines, for a physicist. And so she'd have to like type up all these reports. So like every single week she'd get private physics lessons to be able to understand what she was typing up to make sure the end result was coherent. And so like learning about the physics of optics and light and color really informed her crystal practice. And she used to inform us that color accounts for only about 1/14 of a crystal's energy. And it kind of does it opposite to the way we think we do. If I pick up a violet piece of amethyst, it's not generating violet energy, it's not absorbing violet energy, it's actually rejecting or reflecting violet, the specific wavelength that our eyes interpret as violet. It's absorbing the entire rest of the spectrum. So, you know, the energy going in versus the energy it's saying no thank you to is kind of counterintuitive to what we might think when we start thinking about in terms of color therapy versus, you know, color symbolism. And also the shape of the bonds that are being changed by that little tiny bit of tetravalent iron that's in there is so minuscule that most of the quartz is operating like normal quartz that it's made out of. So, you know, most things that are colored in that kind of mechanism, color is a really small proportion of them chemically and structurally. However, color is deeply important psychologically. We as humans have profound relationships to color. So absolutely use color as a tool. But there is another part of this puzzle that's worth dispelling. And it's the idea that the chakra system as we know and love it today is this ancient, immutable thing. The chakra system as we know it today was developed in 1977. There's a really brilliant book by Kirtley Lind called Rainbow Body that discusses the development from traditional Vedic sources to the, you know, modern Western chakra system as we think of it. And there is a point in time in which we start to organize the sequence of colors in that, you know, red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, and violet, or, you know, some version of that. But prior to that, the sequence didn't necessarily look like that. If we go to original sources, you didn't necessarily have the same number of chakras. You didn't necessarily have them in the same place. And, you know, in this small town in North India, might have a totally different map of the human energy system than, you know, a few towns over. Furthermore, chakras were thought of more as like metaphorical doorways through which our consciousness moves on its journey, or as points in which we could kind of, we'll say like download the influence or install the influence of particular mantras and deities in like deity yoga. They weren't really thought of as like energetic organs until we get to the 20th century. So for most of the chakra system's existence, it didn't follow the model we use today. That doesn't mean our model is wrong. It just means that we have to view all of these things as maps. And maps are how we relate to space. You know, if we think about like a 2D map of the Earth is not flat, it is not square, it's not an ellipse, like we can see it from space. It is more or less spherical. And so any way that we try to render this three-dimensional thing in 2D, there are going to be distortions in the projection. There are going to be things that don't quite add up, but they're still useful tools for like navigating. We still use them despite their flaws. The human energy field and human consciousness exist in higher dimensions than we can visualize in 2D or 3D. So anytime we do that, there are distortions, just like there will be taking a 3D globe and mapping them in 2D space. So use the model that works for you, but recognize that there are going to be other maps, other projections that can help us navigate that same space. And if we do that, And we recognize that this one particular sequence of colors and series of places that we focus them on, it doesn't have to be the end all and be all, then we can let go of the rigidity that a blue stone has to go on the throat chakra, a yellow stone has to go on the solar plexus, and so on and so forth. We can look at something like blue lace agate as a really good one to kind of break some of the rules here. Is it good for communication and expression? Sure. But maybe that's not its primary goal. If we think about the way it forms in these concentric bands, if we look at the kinds of clay minerals that are present in it, if we look at a few other things about its makeup, one of the like emerging themes with the blue lace agate is this ability to cultivate resilience by kind of sifting through the layers of the psyche, by eliminating the things that aren't ours, that you know maybe we receive as projections from the world around us, programming from family upbringing, you know, whatever it might be. And as we let go of those things, we naturally become more resilient, more confident. We cultivate a sense of inner and outer strength. If I think about confidence, inner and outer strength, core identities of self, I'm probably using that chakra model going to go to the solar plexus. And as a result, I actually think that's a really great stone for the solar plexus, disregarding the fact that it's blue. You know, we could also maybe look at something like lapis lazuli, you know, that really rich blue color. Some people want to put it at the throat. Some people want to use the brow chakra. And, you know, truthfully, I don't think it's a singular zone. I think the fundamental action that I've witnessed over and over again from working with lapis lazuli is harmonizing our heart and mind, getting our psyche as a whole out of this kind of like fractured state where it's in separate boxes, and bringing it into this state of like integral wholeness, where heart and mind are, you know, one whole continuum. And, you know, the natural expression of that is self-mastery. It's resolving inner conflict. If we resolve inner conflict, we become better mediators of outer conflict. So of course, you're going to communicate better, but that's not its goal. That's the side effect. And so when we start to really think about how is this crystal generating this influence in my life, what is the underlying mechanism? Color can inform part of how we understand that, but we also want to look at things like what it's made out of, how it formed, what its crystal structure looks like, any other kind of stories that it tells are going to help us understand its whole narrative. And then we get a better and more predictable way to apply the crystal to different sets of circumstances. If I take the same piece of lapis lazuli and apply it to my life, the like surface level end result looks different than someone else's, because we have different psyches, different sets of baggage. We got different inner blockages, outer blockages. So the same mechanism applied to two different sets of circumstances can sometimes give us different end goals. And if we work on this reductive crystal color chakra correspondence model, we sometimes get things that are outliers we can't explain. And a lot of people go, oh, well, it must be all made up and none of it matters, so I just won't do it anymore. When in fact, they've discovered that the relationship is far more deeply personal than that.
That is such a great explanation. Thank you for sharing that. I think it's interesting, a little synchronicity that you mentioned lapis. And that's one of my favorite stones, and one that I started wearing and noticing such a deep connection when I was wearing it. Like, so there's a little synchronicity. So I almost wore it today. it's one of my favorites. As far as like shop, let's just say shopping, if you want to dip your toes into this and you want to source some good quality stones. And also one quick question, do you refer to them as stones or crystals or both?
So as far as terminology goes, there are specific definitions attached to a lot of these words. I say that not to like worry about whether or not we're getting it right, but mostly to remind people that like what things mean colloquially doesn't always equate to what they mean in academic or scientific sense. So, you know, not all the things we use in crystal healing are technically crystals. So, you know, a crystal is a usually solid substance that has a regular composition and a repeating symmetrical structure. So any of those crystals that are naturally occurring and inorganic, we call minerals. So quartz is a mineral, calcite is a mineral, hematite is a mineral, phenakite is a mineral, and so on and so forth. When minerals come together, they become the building blocks of rocks. So some of our favorite so-called crystals in healing are actually rocks. Nephrite and jadeite, lapis lazuli, long list there. And then further, we've got things that don't exactly fit these categories perfectly. So we might consider them to be mineraloids. Maybe they're organic in nature. Maybe they lack a rigorous coherent structure. Maybe there's some other reason. So stuff like amber, jet, obsidian, opal, moldavite, we would consider those mineraloids, and therefore they don't quite fit into one of those categories. But the great news is that whatever term you're using, I mean, anybody who really matters isn't going to correct you. So I'm definitely not going to be the person to knock on your door and say, well, according to the International Mineralogical Association's names, nomenclature, and new mineral species, that's not the right word. I'm never going to do that to someone. So call them rocks, call them crystals, call them stones.
Right. Oh, yes.
Well, and if someone wanted to purchase some, I live close to Moab and Utah. And when I go down there to go camping, there's this amazing rock shop. And I know some of my local Colorado people probably have been there. And so like right as you're either coming into town or leaving town, it's kind of right there off the highway and it's always packed. And I love going in there. And it's just a traditional rock and gemstone and it's so cool. Like they have like the outdoor tables with piles of different things that they've mined and brought in locally. And then of course some international things. And then I go in there and I'm lost for an hour and a half and I come out with, you know, little bags of this and that. And I always find some cool things. So that's one way certainly of shopping. If you live near an area where you can visit your local gem and rock shop. And then also and I'm kind of hesitant to buy things online, for some reason, because I don't know, am I getting something that's real? What can we look out for as consumers to get real things? There's so many fake things out there.
Yes. But I think the conversation it's easy to become alarmist, because of a few notable examples. There's lots of fake moldavite on the market, but like there's been lots of fake moldavite on the market for 20 years now. It certainly increased in 2020, but it's been there for a while. Absolutely, you're going to find things being sold as reconstituted quartz that are in fact just glass. There's no such thing as reconstituted quartz. It is just a fancy marketing ploy to sell you regular glass for more money. No, it is probably not pure quartz because most glass is not pure quartz. Unless you get the really expensive fused silica glass, in which case, like we use that for optical technology, not for making cute little trinkets. But although we have those kinds of examples, there are a lot of things that are just cheaper to get from the earth. You know, I get asked on a regular basis, how can I tell if my obsidian is real? Well, I mean, if it's black glass, it's probably obsidian. It's, you can pick it up by the truckload in so many parts around the world. That it's easy to get, whereas making glass that shade of black is hard. It would cost more to produce the same end result with an artificially colored man-made black glass than just to pick up a piece of obsidian somewhere in the world and ship it somewhere else and have the lapidary work done. So the things that we need to do to be informed consumers are to research what a few important terms mean. So artificial or simulated stones are things that only look like their counterparts. So like opalite resembles opal, but it doesn't share any, you know, physical, optical, chemical, structural principles with it. Then we have synthetic. So that would be like quartz that is grown in a laboratory, not quartz that is melted down, but actual crystals of quartz grown in a laboratory, or like our synthetic gemstones we find in, you know, the jewelry trade. We can also look at things that are treated. So treated gems fall under a lot of categories. Some treatments are really subtle and may improve the aesthetic value and how much you care about something. You know, a ruby that is heat treated is far more likely to be an intense, rich red color than one that isn't. Same with our, you know, deep blue sapphires. Some things like low quality amethyst can be heat treated to look like low quality citrine, which is in far less abundant supply. Other treatments can include irradiation and dyeing and stabilization, where things get impregnated with like polymers and waxes and other things, fillers essentially, to keep them stable so they don't fall apart to be polished. A vast majority of natural turquoise undergoes a process of stabilization so it can be cut and polished into jewelry. A very small percentage of natural turquoise has a high enough silica content that it can withstand that and therefore doesn't need this stabilization. We can look at things that are, you know, coated in epoxy or treated with really superficial kinds of things. In the traditional gemstone industry, we have like metal diffusion and other kinds of like really hard to identify treatments that, unless you have the right equipment or you're willing to cut some stuff open, it can be hard to see what's going on. So as like a newbie consumer, someone kind of inexperienced, there are a few questions that you can ask that don't sound accusatory, like, is this stuff even real? Not a great question. That's gonna put your crystal vendors on defensive, and you're likely to have some missed moments of connection here. It's a really good thing that we can practice asking or looking for is provenance. Where does this material come from? If you know that you're looking at something like ophitic dolerite, better known as Preseli bluestone, and it's only found in Mynydd Preseli in Pembrokeshire, Wales, and you see something that looks a lot like it and is labeled that, and something looks off, and you say, hey, do you know the provenance? And someone goes, oh yeah, this is a new material from India. You know, well, it's not Preseli bluestone because it only comes from Mynydd Preseli. Same for other things that have like really recognizable locations. So provenance is great. Another thing we can do is just ask, do you know of any treatments that might have been applied to this rock, this mineral, this crystal? Remember that polishing is a treatment, technically. So be willing to have really open-ended conversations and be willing to learn. And that's a great one, because then go, oh, actually, yeah, this is heat-treated citrine. If you're looking for the natural material, I do have some of that. It's a little more expensive, but it's right over here. And they'll take you to that area instead. Or, yeah, so this shade of blue and turquoise is pretty much always created through irradiation. We don't often have access to a really intensely blue topaz in jewelry form. I have some rough blue topaz that I can show you somewhere else that is natural, if you like. And, you know, ask those kinds of questions, because then, you know, we're not getting into that offensive, defensive kind of relationship, and we open up the floor for education. I think most people are willing to share what they know. We also have to remember that our crystal vendors are doing the best. We hope that our crystal vendors are doing the best they can with the tools they've got. And some folks just don't have the mineral science background or the gemological background to know this kind of stuff. So they're trusting someone else's word. That doesn't mean they're bad people. Doesn't mean they're good people. It just means they're people. So, you know, be willing to learn and grow. And then one bit of homework that I will give people, if they're really concerned with trying to know the difference between treated and natural and synthetic and simulated, is go look for the fake stuff. Go out of your way to find it. Ideally in person, as often as you can. Go to big trade shows and look for, you know, the terrible fluorescent yellow jade that you know is poured resin. Go look for the so-called reconstituted amber that's mostly plastic with little bits of natural amber embedded in it. Go look for hydrothermally grown synthetic quartz and, you know, all this kind of stuff. Because the more you see it, the more you handle it, you're going to be able to compare that to what you see elsewhere in the field. Conversely, go look for the really, really good stuff that maybe is out of your budget, that is entirely natural, and see if you can build this like mental lexicon. Notice the relative weight and color and texture and, you know, all that other stuff. There is a saying in geology that the best geologist is the one who's seen the most rocks. It's not the one that has the degree from the best university or has the best lab equipment or the cushiest, best paying job, or who necessarily has been doing it the longest. It's the one who goes out to look for rocks in a museum, at a trade show, in your local rock and mineral store, out in the field. It doesn't matter. Just go see rocks. The more you see, the more experience you've got, the more you ask the intelligent kinds of questions, you're going to get so much more out of it.
That's such a great answer to that question. Thank you for sharing that. If you are a consumer walking into a rock shop, do you
do you think it's normal to like kind of tap into your intuition and just gravitate toward a stone that you might be interested in? Because I feel like when I walk into a rock shop, I'm kind of drawn that way, like, because it is sort of overwhelming. You walk in and there are just thousands of stones everywhere, and it can be kind of overwhelming. And so what I find myself doing is, where do I want to walk? Where do I, you know, what am I called to? And if I start handling a few things and I just kind of feel like sort of an energetic aligning, is that a way to kind of, because it can be overwhelming, I think.
Yeah. You know, there's so many ways that we can find the right tools for us, whether this is crystals or whatever else that we work with. Trusting our instincts is always the best place to get started. We can get prescriptive. We can consult with a book. That's why people like me write books like we write, so people have that resource. But at the end of the day, you know, if you're looking at my pocket encyclopedia, for example, there's this much room on a page where I describe to you what a crystal does, and it has more story to tell than that. Just like if I had to reduce my life to that much on a page, I'm going to leave out some details. So when you're in the crystal stores, the first place, the best place to get started in the beginning is, what am I drawn to? What do I love? And what do I love about this? It can be the color. It can be the way it feels in your hand. It can be an inner knowing. It can be the way it catches the light. Don't try to get hung up on, oh, is it just because it's pretty? Just trust that you love what you love. In part because there is this kind of instinctual or intuitive connection that we often find with stones that represent the stuff that we're working on, or the particular, we'll say, chapter of healing in our lives. We might be drawn to such and such crystal as we need it. The other reason is, if you start with what you love, you're going to be more inclined to work with it. If you read in a book that blue apatite is exactly, like, it just aligns with your situation best of all, and you take one look at it and you go, I just hate this shade of neon blue, like everything about it turns me off, then it turns out blue apatite isn't probably going to be something you look forward to working with every day, whether or not it sounds perfect on paper. So, you know, start with what you love, because it'll help you build a habit, build a relationship. But there is a flip side to this. I always invite people to pay attention to the stones that give them the opposite response. Now, sometimes a stone just isn't for us. Sometimes you pick up a piece of hematite and you go, oh, no, never doing that again. Does that mean all hematite? Maybe. Does it mean just this one? Maybe. But, you know, just note that. But every now and then, you know, we pick up a stone and it's like, you know, that feeling in the pit of your stomach just drops out and you're like, oh, this is super uncomfortable. Oftentimes we will experience discomfort with crystals that reflect like a hidden part of our lives that we're working on healing, that reflect a part of our journey that we have yet to master. They represent an energy so far outside of our everyday experience that it feels alien to us because it's uncomfortable. And working with those crystals can help us integrate a deeper kind of healing. And over time, they start to feel a lot comfier. Doesn't mean that we should buy a 10-pound piece and like tape it to our heart chakra and keep it on us all day long. Like, maybe pick 5 minutes out of your day where you have the right mental space, enough bandwidth to like devote to that sense of discomfort and just sort through it. And then go get your favorite like warm and fuzzy feeling crystal afterwards. So just know that whatever you're using to navigate finding new crystals, start with what you love, be open to being wrong frequently, and try things that feel different or uncomfortable from time to time, because they can be really profound teachers.
Yeah, that's great. And I think that's how a lot of healing works too. You start where you are, and you just start with what resonates with you, and then you kind of go from there. And there's a reason that you're drawn to certain things. So I think that definitely aligns with stones and crystals. And I wanted to ask you before we wind up about any current offerings that you have going on. I know you've taught at the College of Psychic Studies, where I'm a student also. And then I know you've got like some Patreon things going on. You've got your new books. And of course, I'll put a link to your website so people can find out more uniquely about, because you offer so much, they can kind of drill down into what is most interesting to them. So definitely like, what do you have coming up currently? I know you've got something going on at the Omega Institute, and I can't remember what else there was, but.
Yeah, so it's going to be a busy kind of end of year push into an even busier start in the new year. This month, I've got some travel. I'll be headed up to the Omega Institute. I'm also doing some Reiki training, East Coast and West Coast. I'm going to be introducing some more in-person events in my local Central Florida area, and then trying to get some other shorter and longer distance journeys planned as well in the coming time. I do have some new courses also being hosted by the College of Psychic Studies that we've put together through the end of the year, and are, you know, going to start looking into the coming terms as well. Every month I do a free online Reiki share. Every month I try to create, when I have the bandwidth, new content for my Patreon subscribers as well. Some of that is seasonal. Some of it is like hitting the basics of crystals. And one of the things that I really pride myself on is like having a diverse array of topics. So, you know, some months are really Reiki heavy. Some months are really mineral science heavy. Some are really into folklore. Some are more on like the vibrational medicine side of things. But I do keep myself pretty busy. I like variety. My brain, my neurotype thrives on a little bit of chaos, but also thrives on the ability to try a little of this and then try a little of that. And when you do that for enough decades, you get good at those things. And so now I'm in a place to share a lot of it. But coming up in January is when my next book is going to drop, and it's called Crystals for Psychic Self-Defense. It is a very thorough guide to exactly what it sounds like. It's got 145 crystals in the directory that focus on things like protection, remediation of psychic attack, banishing harmful energies, and so on and so forth. You've got chapters devoted to things like proactive care for like personal protection and personal psychic shields, environmental care, whether we're talking like geopathic stress and disruptive energies in our environment, or warding our home, what to do when it feels like we're the target, intentionally or not, of some, you know, very pointed energies coming our way, and then some more advanced techniques that kind of populate the remaining chapters in the book. So this was truly a labor of love. This book took me longer than any other to write. From the time that I started it until the time that it comes out, two other books have been started, completed, and hit shelves before this one finally has. So I'm really excited about its upcoming birthday.
I love hearing about all the authors and all of the author processes that go on. And how many books do you have out now?
Currently I have 9 on, or okay, 8 on shelves. This one will be my 9th. Wow. And I can drop a little teaser that in later in 2025, my 10th book will come out. Title TBA. I'm waiting, okay, for, you know, some approval to start sharing some more stuff about it, but it's a little bit of a different direction, and I'm very excited. This was a lot of fun to put together.
Oh, nice. And then the next one, the Crystals for Psychic Self-Defense, that one comes out in January, and can people pre-order that one?
Absolutely. So wherever books are sold, you head on down to your local indie bookseller, let them know that you'd like to pre-order, or let them know you're interested in getting it when it comes in. If you do Amazon, Books A Million, Barnes & Noble, Powell's, Waterstones, if you're in the UK, you can also order from, you know, any of those sources. Every avenue for finding books is a good avenue for authors. So do what works best for you.
Right. Thank you. Thank you for sharing that. I want to thank you so much for coming on and sharing this wealth of a deep dive into crystals and stones and healing and all of the things that you've been up to, including your writing process and how you got started with this. It's been such an unpeeling back of your information, which is just vast, vast.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's been a delightful chat.
Yes, thank you so much. I hope everyone has enjoyed this episode. And if you need more information, this is just a teaser, just a tiny snippet of all of this information. And if you would like to find that, please drop us the name of your website again.
So that is theluminouspearl.com.
Perfect. And I will put that link in the show notes and any other links that we can add just to easily so that you can click on those and go straight to his website or books, especially the new book. I'll put that one in there. Thank you so much, Nicholas, for coming on and sharing this.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Hey, thanks for listening today to another great episode. I sure enjoy hearing about these experiences, and I hope you do also. Be sure and like or follow this show by leaving a 5-star review on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen. If you have an experience or story you'd like to share, be sure and reach out to verbalecho@gmail.com. See you in the next episode, friends. Have a great week.